And that's the outline of my talk. I'll first talk about scattering equivalence of Hamiltonians. Then a little bit about quantum electrodynamics and renormalization. So these two subjects are pretty standard from textbooks. And then about dressed particle approach itself, and then probably some provocative questions for discussion. Do we have like 1 hour time? Okay. Okay, first, scattering equivalence of Hamiltonian. What does it mean? I'll start with some basic quantum theory. We have Hamiltonian H, which is composed of non-interacting part H0 and interaction V. And in standard quantum mechanics, we can also define time evolution operator, which is exponent of the Hamiltonian, of the full interacting Hamiltonian. And this time evolution operator allows us to know everything about how system evolves in time. We start from state of the system psi of t, and applying time evolution operator, we get state of the system at any other time t prime. So that's. But in many cases, we don't need to know exact time evolution. That's just too much and too difficult to calculate. In such cases like scattering, we only have three particles colliding with each other. Something happens in the interaction region. We actually don't really know, or maybe don't even care what happens there. And what we see is just other particles leaving the region of interaction. And in experiment, we can measure only asymptotic states here and asymptotic states here, and try to connect these two asymptotic states in our theory. I did something wrong. Oh, interesting. Okay. Sorry. Let's try it again. I pressed some wrong button. Okay, so let me try to give a sketch of description of scattering event. Here on the horizontal axis, I plot time, and on vertical axis is some schematic representation of the state of the system. And when at large negative times, where particles are far apart from each other, the interacting time evolution is very close to non-interacting time evolution, which I represent here by a broken line. And also at large times, particles again are separated, and interacting time evolution, which is this full line, approaches some non-interacting limit. So we actually have two asymptotes at negative times and at positive times. And there is a gap. If we continue these asymptotes to time zero, there is a gap, and this gap is described what is called S operator or S matrix. So in the S matrix representation, we actually don't try to reproduce exact time evolution of the system, and we approximate this time evolution by this simple picture that particles move non-interacting until time zero, then sudden jumps occur, and then they continue non-interaction without interaction to infinite future. So in this S operator representation, we don't have clear view of exact time evolution, but we can exactly map asymptotic states in the infinite past to the asymptotic state in the infinite future. And from this picture, one can easily derive this formula for the S operator. This is exact formula, but it's useless for calculations, of course. And in order to do realistic calculations of the S operator, several techniques were devised, like perturbation theory. And here you can recognize usual Feynman-Dyson perturbation expansion, which allows you to calculate the S operator. But for our purposes, we'll use a little bit different perturbation expansion. It's called Magnus perturbation theory. It is totally equivalent to the Feynman-Dyson perturbation theory if we have opportunity to sum contributions to all orders. But it has some nice features. The S operator is represented as an exponent where operator F is sometimes called scattering phase operator. And it is constructed from interaction and its commutators. There is infinite series here with more and more complex commutators. But what's important that this is Hermitian operator. And therefore, S operator here is explicitly unitary, which is kind of nice property. And we'll see how this commutator representation will help us later. So if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer during my talk. Now, suppose that we know exact S operator of our theory in all orders. Is this information sufficient to find the Hamiltonian of our theory? In other words, is there full information about the system contained in the S operator? And the answer is no. And this question was investigated in some detail by Eckstein in 1960. And this goes by the name scattering equivalence of Hamiltonian. So his conclusion was that two Hamiltonians, H and H prime, will yield the same S operator if these Hamiltonians are related by unitary transformation, where phi is a Hermitian operator which has some smooth properties. It's enough to say that it should not be, it should not have singularities. So otherwise, any operator will be good for this transformation. So there is a huge class of unitary transformations and huge class of different Hamiltonians, which will produce for us exactly the same S operator. Of course, we know that these two Hamiltonians will have identical energy of bound states, but they also will have exactly the same scattering amplitudes, exactly the same decay rates of unstable states, and so on. And one important thing to realize that the scattering equivalence of two Hamiltonians doesn't mean their exact physical equivalence. And I'll try to explain a little bit. Yes. Turn back.
Is that also the necessary condition for the H and H prime use the same S matrix?
Yes.
You mean that condition, the unitary transformation, is both sufficient and the necessary condition for obtain the same S matrix?
Oh. So it is sufficient that if you have H and H prime connected by this formula where phi is smooth, I can write exactly what it means to be smooth, but just think about it that it doesn't have singularities. If this is satisfied, that there is guarantee that S operators computed with H prime and H will be the same. But you're asking, does this set of Hamiltonians exhaust all possibilities?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is necessary, I'm not sure about that. Probably yes, but I won't speculate. For us, it would be important that this is a sufficient condition here. So let's see what kind of experiments we do in high energy physics and how these experiments are reflected in our theory. So the basic types of experiments are like measurements of scattering cross sections, lifetimes, decay rates of unstable particles and states, energies of bound states, like of atoms or nuclei. All these properties are easily measured in experiments. And what's interesting is that all of these properties are contained in the S matrix. Like scattering cross sections can be calculated from S matrix elements. Position of poles of the S matrix will give us energies of bound states and decay rates. But there are some other properties which can be measured in experiment, in principle, which do not fit in the S matrix. They cannot be computed from S matrix elements. For instance, wave functions of bound states, they're defined in theory as eigenvectors or eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian, and you need to know full interacting Hamiltonian to calculate them. Like time evolution is also requires knowledge of the full Hamiltonian. And as we saw on this graph, S matrix or S operator doesn't give us information about type evolution, only in some approximate asymptotic sense. There is also decay law of unstable states and unstable particles, which is relatively easy measured in experiments for long-lived particles, which also requires knowledge of the Hamiltonian. But I'll talk about this particular issue on Wednesday. I'll have a seminar. So we'll leave alone this point today. So we see that there are some experimental stuff which doesn't fit into the S matrix and requires Hamiltonian. This means that different scattering equivalent Hamiltonians will result in different predictions for this stuff. They will be exactly equivalent in what is concerned this part of experiment, but they will be different for wave functions of bound states and time evolution. So this means that two scattering equivalent Hamiltonians are not physically equivalent.
So I can see very well the decay law, which may change from one Hamiltonian to the other. And the decay law, in principle, it could be measured, right? I have thousands of copies of some particle, and I
yes.
can go and try to, I don't know how, but I guess I can. But what about the wave function? This is not observable. Why do you say that it gives different predictions? Wave function, what do you know about it?
In principle, you can measure like square of modulus of the wave function in position space, and also square of modulus of the wave function in momentum space, or in any other representations. That's measurable. That's, for instance, is given by charge density of atom in position space, or...
Can you measure that?
I think so. Yes, there are measurements in atomic molecular physics, where you can see, at least in position space, but
yeah.
you can also do it in momentum space, or in principle in some other representation. And combining these measurements together, you can, in principle, reproduce the full wave function of the state. So it's difficult, and I'm not sure if it has been done from any non-trivial system, but in principle it's measurable.
So, I finish it. So, and how shall different scattering influence Hamiltonian give different wave functions? Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So, conclusion is that there is infinite number of scattering equivalent Hamiltonians which yield almost, that's important, the same observable fit. Okay, we are done with scattering equivalence. Now, a few words about quantum electrodynamics. How we can apply this knowledge to quantum field theory. Okay, here I wrote the Hamiltonian of quantum electrodynamics in the Coulomb gauge interaction picture, where A dagger A operators for electrons, B dagger B for positrons, C dagger C for photons, and the non-interacting Hamiltonian is just sum of energies of these particles, and the interaction is written here. It depends on quantum fields defined for these particles, but for my purposes, I don't want to work with quantum fields. I want to expand all quantum fields into creation and annihilation operators. And of course, after I do that, I'll get long and ugly expression. But I would rather work with it and see what comes out of that. So in this expression, I can organize all terms into three groups. And I'll call these groups renorm terms, phase terms, and unphase terms. It's my own terminology, but I don't know what's accepted terminology. Sometimes people call this unphase bad operators, but there is no well accepted terminology as far as I know. So what's the difference between these kinds of terms? Renorm operators are always one. I need to mention that it's all in normally ordered form. So creation operators are on the left, destruction are on the right. Renorm operators always have one destruction operator, one creation, and they correspond to the same particle. So example of those terms are here in a free Hamiltonian. Then there are phase operator, which comes from physical. And you will see later why I use these names. They have at least two creation operators, two or more, and at least two annihilation operators, two or more. Some examples are written here. And finally, the rest I call unphase or unphysical. You can see here, these are operators which are traditionally coming from this trilinear part of interaction. Now, what's different between these three classes? The difference is in their time dependence. So we should understand, of course, that each of these operator products enters with its coefficient function, which depends on moment of particles created and annihilated by the operators. And also one part of this coefficient function depends on time. And dependence is always has this form where E, I'll call it energy function is simply energy of free particles annihilated minus energy of particles created by the operator. So if we have renorm terms, we create and annihilate the same particle with the same energy, so energy function is identically zero, and renorm operators do not depend on time. Now, for phase operators, one can show that there is always a hypersurface in the momentum space where energies of created and annihilated particles are the same. It's called energy shell. So, and on this energy shell, energy function is zero. And for unphase operator, this energy equality condition is never satisfied, so energy function is never zero. Okay, now let us try to do simple calculation of S operator. I'll remind you that all this textbook stuff, just go through it to make it clear what new I have made. Our interaction operator is a long expression. I just put here a few terms. We plug in this operator into commutator, if you remember Magnus' perturbation theory, calculate the commutator and get a huge number of terms, and put these terms in a normal order and classify them into phase terms, unphase, renorm. And then we need to take integral by t from minus to plus infinity. And now that's the place where the time dependence comes in. For phase operators, we told that E has energy shell where it's zero, and integration results in delta function of E, which is simply expression of energy conservation in scattering events. For unphase terms, E prime is never zero, so integral is zero, they drop out. But the big problem is with renorm terms. They do not depend on time, and so their integral is formally infinite. So we obtain senseless result that our scattering operator is infinite. Now, what can we do about that? The solution is well known. It's mass renormalization, which was suggested in the late 40s by Tomonaga, Schwinger, and Feynman. And the solution is to add to the Hamiltonian, which we've written previously, some counter terms, and select these counter terms in such a way that all renorm terms from the S operator will cancel out in each perturbation order. So what we basically do in renormalization, instead of our original operator Hamiltonian of QED, we construct new operator, which I call HC, Hamiltonian with counter terms, by adding some extra terms here in each perturbation order. So there are terms of renorm type, which I'll call mass renormalization counter terms, and there are terms of unphase type, like charge renormalization counter terms. And what's interesting about that coefficient functions of these terms are given by divergent integral. So formally they're infinite. But nevertheless, all the cancellations in S matrix calculation work out so that result is finite for the S matrix and remarkably accurate. So as you know, QED agrees with experiment to some incredible precision. So that's how I understand the idea of renormalization.
What is concurrent?
What?
So how many concurrent do you have?
There are infinite number. In each perturbation order, you have a specific counter term. But normally what people do, they collect the log all together and notice that this A dagger A is the same type of which goes in operator H0 mass term, and they put all this, add all these terms to the mass term in H0, then it becomes the mass of the particle sort of infinite. And why they call that bare particles in quantum field theory have infinite mass. And they also collect all these charged renormalization counting terms in each order and notice that they have the same structure as interaction in B, add them to this interaction, and it appears that our particles have infinite charge. That's another way of looking at it. But I would prefer to keep this picture, that mass renormalization and charge renormalization counter terms actually like additional terms to the interaction, rather than correction to masses and charges. That's how I prefer to consider them. Okay, so we got accurate and finite S operator, but our Hamiltonian became quite weird. It has formally infinite terms. And what's even more important, in my opinion, that it's not suitable for calculations of, for example, time evolution. Even if we forget about infinities, it's still not good. So let's say we start with initial state, which is just one electron. Our initial state is electron creation operator acting from vacuum. And try to calculate time evolution of this state with our QED Hamiltonian with renormalization counter terms. And one can easily see that in addition to one electron states, we'll have states with one electron, one photon, one electron, many photons, one electron, many electron-positron pairs. So we'll get a full cloud of virtual particles surrounding our electron. So nobody has seen this kind of behavior of electrons in experiment. Normally, if we have one electron, it remains as electron in the absence of any interactions for any period of time. And this problem is also well understood in quantum field theory. The reason is that our initial operators, A dagger and A, they don't refer to physical real electrons. They refer to so-called bare electrons, which, as I mentioned, formally have infinite charges and masses. Of course, one can make these charges and masses finite by introducing cutoff in momentum space, but eventually we'll need to make this cutoff go to infinity. And in this limit, that's what we get. And the question is, why should we care about these bare electrons if they're not observable in experiments? Why cannot we reformulate our theory in terms of physical or dressed particles? That's the idea of the dressed particle approach. And now I switch to dressed particle approach. So the idea is to, instead of the Hamiltonian HC with counter terms of quantum electrodynamics, the idea is to find a different Hamiltonian, which we'll call HD, dressed particle Hamiltonian, which has some nice properties. We will require first that this Hamiltonian must yield the same S matrix as a traditional renormalized QED. And as you remember from the beginning of my talk, there is a chance to achieve that because we know that the same S matrix can be produced by many different Hamiltonians. So there is a chance that we have in this huge class of scattering equivalent Hamiltonians at least one, or maybe more than one, which has these features that it's finite, and the interaction term has phis, belongs to the phis class. So we would expect this Hamiltonian to have this form, H0 as usual, an interaction where each term is phis. So it has at least two creation and at least two annihilation operators. So why do we want to have only phis interaction terms? It can be proven quite easily that commutator of two phis terms gives us again phis term. If we use this property in the S matrix calculation by Magnus perturbation formula, we'll see that each summand here has phis character. So we'll never get bad renorm terms in our S operator. So we will never need to worry about renormalization. So if we do that, then mass and charge renormalization is actually not needed. And one can also show that one can guarantee that all loop integrals which we can meet in these calculations will converge. And also these dressed particle Hamiltonians will have a very nice feature, like the possibility to calculate time evolution. So by construction, this Hamiltonian yield zero when acting, the interacting part of the Hamiltonian yield zero when it acts on the vacuum and one particle states. Due to the presence of two annihilation, at least two annihilation operators here, it always yields zero when acting on vacuum and one particle states. So it also means that vacuum and one particle states are eigenvectors of the full interacting Hamiltonian. So we managed to get rid of self-interactions in vacuum and in one particle states. So electron prepared at time zero will remain as electron at all other times. That looks more consistent with experimental situation.
One particle state in H, because if we have an electron, we will have an electromagnetic field around it. So,
okay.
How to understand?
Can we talk about that a bit later?
Okay.
I'll probably come to that point when I speak about the interaction between dressed particles. Okay. Now, that's all just general properties, but can we really calculate explicit form of dressed particle Hamiltonian for some realistic theory like QED? And there are basically three methods to do that. One is applying unitary dressing transformation directly and choose this operators phi so that they eliminate all bad unphys terms from our Hamiltonian, so that HD contains only phys type interactions. Another approach was suggested by Weber and collaborators is to use Gell-Mann-Feynman theorem, but I'm not well familiar with this approach. And the third method is we can just directly fit our Hamiltonian order by order to the known S matrix of QED. So if we know S operator in a particular perturbation order in QED, then there are straightforward formulas how one can obtain Hamiltonian in the same order. One important point that all these methods, they don't yield a unique Hamiltonian. There remains some ambiguity. But this ambiguity is completely understandable because the same, our experimental knowledge about microscopic particles comes mainly from scattering experiments, from S-matrix. And as we discussed, there are many Hamiltonians which can describe exactly the same S-matrix. And we don't have means to choose which Hamiltonian is better. But at least we have some class of Hamiltonians, dressed partic Hamiltonians, which we think have nice properties and have a good chance to correspond to one unique exact Hamiltonian of nature. And actually this, yes?
That's fine. Being related by a unitary transformation.
Yes.
This Hamiltonian has the same spectrum.
Yes.
So are they equivalent?
They have the same energy spectrum, but they have different wave functions of states. So if you have two Hamiltonians,
a unitary transformation as well.
Yes, but unitary transformation will preserve for you energy spectrum values of eigenvectors, eigenvalues, but not eigenvectors. For these two spectra will have the same energy levels, but different wave functions associated with each energy level.
Yeah, but which one is unitary transformed?
Yeah. Yes, but they are not physically equivalent.
Is a unitary transformation?
If you try to calculate time of evolution, you will get the different results with even though Hamiltonians are connected to each other by unitary transformations, the time evolution will be different.
So we've been discussing this all morning, so we have different perspectives. I think I agree.
So I don't think that it's a unitary transformation in Hilbert space.
I think some H, and this is a perfectly defined operator with this spectrum, right? So from this, I think in principle you could find everything else.
From
the spectrum. So an operator is given.
From energy spectrum?
Yeah, intrinsically is given by its energy spectrum.
But you know only values of energies.
Yeah.
You don't know what.
I don't need that. I mean, there, in order to build operator. There will be a basis in the inverse space, there will be a basis of the vectors of those states. And it's not the orthonorm, and this is what I mean.
Well, take the simplest case, the spin half particle.
Yeah.
You've got a Hamiltonian which represents a magnetic field interaction in the z direction. And
yeah.
You can usually evolve it. That implies you're talking about another interaction along some other axis.
Yeah.
The energy spectrum will be the same.
Yeah.
The eigenvectors will be different.
That's right. But it's very fundamental.
Choose a standard apparatus to distinguish between eigenvectors. So I don't see what you're saying.
That's great. But at the very fundamental level, you will have the Hamiltonian of your speed, and you will have the Hamiltonian of your machinery, of your laboratory, etc., etc. So at the very fundamental level, these two configurations, spin there and spin there, are different in terms of the fundamental total Hamiltonian. So my claim is, if I give you the total Hamiltonian of the left, of the spin, of everything, the spectrum of it, even if it's very difficult technically, but the spectrum of it should contain all you need. It's my guess. Probably it's too much, but.
Okay, well, probably.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah. So, I wanted to make a point that in order to define a Hermitian operator, you need two things. You need its spectrum of eigenvalues, and you need eigenvectors. So two operators having the same spectrum of eigenvalues, but the different eigenvectors, they are different. And they are different physically.
So you need the plane of the technician to be different.
I mean, the way of the definition of the Hamiltonian may be different.
Definition?
Yeah, I mean, the, how to say, the domain, DOF, the domain of the definition.
Domain,
of
probably, yes, but even more than that, they are just different operators. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well. Yes, different. So I wonder because, so is this unitary dressing transformation just a definition or?
Well,
or
I want to make another point. If you want to make it so. Sorry.
No word.
I should not be so excited. So if you want to make two physically equivalent theories,
yeah,
you can apply unitary transformation to one theory,
mm-hmm,
but you need to transform everything in this theory. Hamiltonian, state vectors, all operators of observables. If you transform the whole thing, then you'll get two exactly physically equivalent theories. But here we transform only Hamiltonian. The rest of stuff is the same. And by doing transformation, applied transformation only to the Hamiltonian, we don't get full exact physical equivalence.
You mean if we mirror the momentum by momentum operator to mirror state, then we will get the different momentum distribution, because the momentum operator does not transform by the unitary transformation.
Yes, all other operators are kept,
yeah,
the same. Actually, not exactly. We need to transform all 10 generators of the Poincaré group. I didn't want to touch relativistic invariance here, but together with Hamiltonian, we need to transform also boost operator, total momentum and total angular momentum, and that's it. All other stuff is the same, and two theories are not exactly equivalent. Okay, can I go on?
Yes, just perhaps to fix this point, and then we don't talk about it anymore. At this morning we tend to be on the same side, that perhaps we have a slightly different view on this. So I tend to see that this ambiguity is in fact an ambiguity in defining your dress particle. So I tend to see it like there is more than one way to define what is a dress particle in your model. While you say that there is more,
yes,
than one way to fix the dynamics of the model, and you want to speak with your particles, let's say, I don't know.
Actually, that's a good place to mention. There are two, I think, physically equivalent but philosophically opposite approaches to dressed particles. So one approach was advocated by, for instance, Shirokov, and in the original paper by Greenberg and Schweber, that in dressed particle approach, we try to express our theory in terms of these clouds of virtual particles. So we don't work with bare particles, but we work with the full this virtual particle cloud. And we call it our dressed particle, which is a complex linear combinations of multi-particle states. And we'll try to introduce new creation annihilation operators, which will create and annihilate the whole bunch of stuff, and express our Hamiltonians in terms of this creation annihilation operator. So philosophically, it is like redefinition of the notion of particle in quantum field theory. Instead of bare particle, we work with dressed particles. But there is alternative approach, which is, I'm sure, is physically entirely equivalent. It will give exactly the same results, but philosophically it's different. So the approach is that we just change the Hamiltonian. we leave our particles as they were, electrons, photons, positrons, and we just apply our dressing transformation not to particle creation annihilation operators, but to Hamiltonian. So, in essence, we don't change definition of particles, but we change what kind of interactions act between them. These are totally equivalent approaches. But what you are saying, I think, is that one can find some even intermediate approach. Then we change a little bit definition of particles, and we change a little bit definition of Hamiltonian, and we are somewhere in the middle. So one can go between these two extremes and find some middle ground. Probably that is the most general picture of the particle approach. Okay. And I talked about ambiguity, but there are certain places where ambiguity disappears, and one can calculate an exact form of the rest particle operator. For instance, if we confine ourselves to the second perturbation order near the energy shell, we can calculate rest particle Hamiltonian for interaction between electrons and positrons. And that's what we get. We get usual Darwin braid instantaneous potential. So the interacting, the operator in this part of Fock space is just sum of energies of electron and positron plus some interaction, where interaction has these terms where you can recognize easily Coulomb potential, contact, Darwin potential, which is responsible for magnetic interaction between particles, spin orbit, spin. And there is no ambiguity here. This result is, of course, well known from probably 1930s, where Darwin braid Hamiltonian was fitted to the S matrix of QED in the second perturbation order. And it would be strange if we'll obtain something different. So the only point here that theory seems to work since we get well-known results. But there is nothing new here. And it is well known that this Hamiltonian describes with very good accuracy fine and hyperfine structural positronium, or if we take electron and proton or hydrogen atom, it actually is capable of describing most of classical electrodynamics in the classical limit. And even the Aronoff-Bohm effect, I have a paper written about that recently. But we don't want to stop at second perturbation order. We want to go to 4, 6, and so on. And the goal is to continue this approach. There are some difficulties, mostly technical, associated with infrared divergences, but let us introduce hypothesis that this dressed particle approach can be construction of the Hamiltonian can be completed in all perturbation order. So it hasn't been done, but it looks like general theory is formulated, but actual calculations, like in the case of quantum electrodynamics, they have some technical difficulties. But assume that it is done, and we obtain the full Hamiltonian of quantum electrodynamics in this form. And we can guess what kind of terms will be there in the interaction. And these terms will all of them will correspond to measurable processes like direct electron-positron potential, electron-photon potential. There will be some many particle potentials also in higher perturbation order. And there will be potentials or interaction terms which change number of particles, like electron-positron par creation, annihilation, Bremsstrahlung, and there will be actually infinite number of different kind of potentials. But with higher perturbation order, the strength of this potential will be smaller. And I don't want to touch the issue of convergence of this expansion. That's probably a whole different story. Okay, now we can, there was a question about electromagnetic field. So you are saying that our electron is surrounded by electromagnetic field, and we represent this as a like bunch of virtual photons in the field. But in this theory, what we have, we don't have field. We have particles, charged particles interacting by direct instantaneous potentials. That's probably an interesting feature of this approach. So let me summarize a little bit what we have achieved here. So this rest particle Hamiltonian has a number of advantages as compared to the Hamiltonian of QED. First, it doesn't have infinite terms there. All terms are perfectly well defined. The S-matrix calculation with this operator, it gives exactly the same results as renormalized QED by construction. Doesn't involve divergent integrals, and renormalization is not needed. We just start with a Hamiltonian, plug it into usual perturbation formulas, and get results which are finite without any renormalization and when we introduce cutoffs. Sorry. About the name. Then time evolution of states and observables can be obtained again by usual quantum mechanical formulas. So if we want to calculate our bound states, we just diagonalize this Hamiltonian as a normal non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So there is basically no difference between quantum field theory in this formulation and standard quantum mechanics. The only difference is that our Hamiltonian has interaction terms which can create and annihilate particles. If a normal quantum mechanics, normally number of particles is conserved, here it's not the case. But we, otherwise, they're just the same kind of theory. And what we did, we actually managed to eliminate fields from quantum field theory, which may sound paradoxical. And now this leads to probably more and more controversial question, provocative. So the question is, do we actually need quantum fields in QFT? Why don't work with just particles? Dressed particles which correspond exactly to those like electrons, positrons, protons observed in nature. What about this quote from Weinberg? The idea of quantum field theory is that quantum fields are the basic ingredients of the universe and particles are just bundles of energy and momentum of the field. So you'll see that in dressed particle approach, it's sort of reverse. Particles are the basic ingredients of the universe. And what is the role of fields here? Why do we actually need fields at all? And there is a good reason for that. That's, in my opinion, quantum fields play rather technical but important role in QFT because without them, we have no means to construct relativistically invariant interacting Hamiltonian. Currently, the only way known to construct interactions is to use local gauge invariance principle, which works for quantum electrodynamics, for electroweak interactions, and so on. And we simply have no, I don't know how to construct dressed particle Hamiltonian from some first principle. I simply don't know what these first principles are. So currently what we do, we start with field theory. We write Lagrangian of like QED. Then we go to Hamiltonian of QED. Then if we want to switch to the dressed particle picture, we need to apply unitary transformation to this Hamiltonian and arrive to our physical particle representation. But we cannot create this physical particle Hamiltonian from scratch. We need to go through this long procedure of canonical quantization, renormalization, through all these messy steps in order to arrive to this clean, finite dressed particle Hamiltonian. Now, another probably even more provocative question. We saw that in the second perturbation order, interaction between charges propagated instantaneously. It just was direct action at a deep distance potential. And it looks like in higher perturbation order, we should get the same type of potentials. So is it true that interaction between charges propagate instantaneously, or they are retarded? Okay.
Other experiments?
I mean that in the Coulomb gauge you have this impression, but then if you look at these things properly, you find a relativistic thing.
Other experiments which clearly show that they are retarded? We'll probably discuss it on Thursday. So what are these experiments?
Well, when I call Europe, it becomes a
representation. Yes, so but that's not direct interaction between charges. What happens when you call Europe?
It's electromagnetic field.
But in dressed particle approach, it has a different representation of what happens. What happens, we have, let's say, two charges separated by a large distance. We somehow excite one charge, accelerate it. And due to Bremsstrahlung process, it emits real photons. Not virtual photons, but real photons which we can catch with photographic plates or whatever. And these real photons propagate in space and with speed c, and at some point reach other charge and interact with this charge. So it looks like total interaction between charges is split into two parts. One is the direct forces, like Coulomb or magnetic force. And another is not direct, but sort of indirect interaction transmitted by real photons. That's, I don't know, it's, of course, it's very debatable subject, but I just want to throw this question to you. And probably we'll have a chance to discuss it more on Thursday. And there are also some experiments, again, they're controversial and there are many interpretations of them. But one way to look at them is these are experiments with superluminal effects in electromagnetic processes. There were a lot of them in the 90s and they're still coming up. Which can be explained in different ways, but one of them is to assume that interaction propagates instantaneously. And here I just summarize what I told you, that in this approach there are two parts in interaction between charges. One is instantaneous and another is retarded by transmitted with the real
photons. The Coulomb gauge, right? It's a product, it's by product of the Coulomb gauge.
Also, if you translate back to field theory, that you're saying that if you have a static field, then it's instantaneous. That's not that the interaction propagates instantaneously. It's the propagation interaction you see when you change something. If the field is static, of course,
yeah,
that's.
But this kind of Hamiltonian applies not only to static configurations. As you see, it depends on momenta of particles. So it describes interaction between moving particles. And actually, one can see with some work that most of stuff in classical electrodynamics can be described by this Hamiltonian, like electromagnetic induction, and even.
Yeah, but like even in standard classical electrodynamics, you can do all the calculations in the Coulomb gauge, and this, but it's not possible to have a transmission of any type of signals faster than light. I mean, it's just an artifact of the Coulomb gauge. If you do it the same exactly in the classical mode, I'm so sorry. It comes out all these type of terms come out, but then you look at them carefully, and it turns out that you cannot actually, if you move a charge here, it takes a while to be.
Okay, I probably would like to make two points. One is that I'm not sure if there are experiments which clearly show, apart from this radio transmission, which I think I explained. Are there other experiments which clearly tell you that interaction between charges propagates in retardant form? That's one thing. And another thing, we'll discuss it on Thursday. I'll try to explain you why instantaneous propagation doesn't actually contradict relativity. That's probably the point which you have, that instantaneous propagation is impossible because it contradicts relativity. But I'll try to convince you that it's not so. I'm sure it's controversial subject, but why not have discussion about that?
Change of view then?
Okay,
conclusion? Oh, sorry.
Just one slide. Yeah, I just wanted to mention some references about dressed particle theory quickly.
Yes.
So the initial ideas was expressed by Van Hoff in the middle of the 50s, where he wrote about persistent self-interactions between particles in quantum field theory, and that we need to get rid of those self-interactions. The most important paper is this Grimmick and Schweber. I highly recommend this. It's very clearly written and educational. In 1963, Fadeev applied perturbation theory to dressed particle approach. One important paper, Vishnesko and Shirokov, where they expressed the idea that renormalization can be formulated in this way. And currently, there are several groups, one in Japan, working on nuclear forces in this approach, and another group I know in Ukraine, led by Shebeko, also applying to nuclear forces. And you can find more details in two reviews. Probably that's it. Yeah. Thank you very much. With Hoch's theorem? Oh, that's a good question. There is actually a paper recently. It's a paper by Shirokov, which he wrote, I believe, in the 70s, long time ago. But it was there, existed as a preprint of Dubna Institute, or Joint Institute of Nuclear Research. And I love this paper so much that I contacted Shirokov and suggested him to translate this paper and put it in the archive it deals exactly with this question, how dressed particle approach agrees or disagrees with Hoeck's theorem. Okay, Hoeck's theorem, let me, yeah.
What you thought was your interacting Hamiltonian is actually going to be a free field Hamiltonian in the sense that you get trivial S matrix.
Okay. So in other words, the idea is that interacting fields cannot transform in manifestly covariant way. That's another formulation of Hoeck's theorem.
Yeah, that would be one of the Whiteman axioms you'd have to reject,
yes,
if you wanted it to work.
And I don't know, I can dig out this reference. It was probably last year in MathFiz archive. Oh, I can find it here. Just a moment.
If you look it up.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject to discuss. Let me see. I'll find it here. Sure.
So maybe a follow-up question then is just how this program relates to attempts to construct models of, like in the axiomatic and constructive field theory tradition. Of how does this program relate to attempts to construct rigorous models?
But we do for quantum electrodynamics.
Right.
Is it good?
Well, so it hasn't worked, right? So that's why I'm wondering how.
Oh, it hasn't worked. I told you that there are technical difficulties, but they go away if we work with massive particles. The problem is with massless photons.
Right.
The infrared divergences arise from the possibility of creation of infinite number of soft photons. And then everything becomes so messy that it's difficult to formulate dressed particle Hamiltonians. But I consider it a technical problem. But if your particles, all of them are massive, like in nuclear forces, then everything goes smoothly. You can do this program without a problem. So you can take a look at this. It's not physics. Yeah, that's the one. The title of this paper is Dressing and Hoeck's Theorem. So probably we can discuss later.
Sure. Thank you.
So Greenberg and Schaefer also made a comment on that, right? In Hoeck's
theorem? Yes, yes, yes,
like
yes,
that,
yes.
The dressing operation is not unitary anymore.
Right,
yes,
that would be another
actually
way of doing it. If it's not, yeah. It's
the history is how I read this history. Greenberg, in few years after this paper, he published another paper where he said that probably the stressed particle transformation doesn't agree with Hoeck's theorem and created this controversy and probably abandoned this approach.
Yeah.
Actually,
This is all happening about the same time, right? How's
yes,
the paper
yes,
55
yes, yes.
And 57?
But this paper argues that there is no problem.
Okay.
The actually dressed particle approach fixes the problem you encounter with Hoeck's theorem.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah, it's a little confusing. So you said that the stressed particle approach gives you something which is scattering equivalent to the standard quantum dynamics, but then you also say, well, that's not all of the story. So
yes.
Can you say that this is proposing a different theory which is physically distinguishable from the standard
it's
one?
Physically distinguishable,
yeah.
But only for kind of processes which are very difficult to measure.
Yeah.
Like time evolution in the scattering region. Nobody can see there.
Mm-hmm.
But we think that something happens there. Some time evolution happens there, and eventually we could be able to probe it.
So you could make predictions for this which would contradict normal quantum electrodynamics, but they haven't been measured yet. So they're not something for the future.
Yes, but in normal quantum electrodynamics, I don't know how to build time evolution operator. Because first, Hamiltonian is infinite, and second, it creates all these clouds of virtual particles, which I don't know.
So it's hard to come up with an example where there'd be a definite contradiction or a definite contrast between the two things. Because you're saying it's hard to calculate those things.
It's hard to measure. And in calculations, we also have this issue with ambiguity of Hamiltonians. I don't know how to select one unique Hamiltonian, but if supposedly some experimental results will come out about time evolution, like there are some measurements in atoms, on Rydberg states of atoms, where they can excite high-lying orbitals and see how they evolve with time. But usually this kind of processes that they described with normal, like non-relativistic quantum mechanics, they don't involve any rotative corrections. But if we could excite low-lying states which are affected by lamp shift, and if we could measure time evolution there, then probably there should be some radiative corrections, not only to energy, but also to wave functions, and this should affect time evolution. And in principle, we could measure these stress particle interactions. But it's tough.
Yes.
So, this thing is bigger.